is Kirk Schneider, and our chair, Stephen Wade, is out today and unable to even call in, so I'm going to fill in for him. So I welcome everyone here to the Motor Vehicle Advisory Board meeting. I appreciate everyone taking the time. First thing on the agenda is public comment, and I don't see anyone here from the public, so I guess we can move past that. You guys tell me if I'm screwing this up, please. Okay, so far so good. So then why don't we look at our previous minute meetings or meeting minutes, and we'll approve those. Clint, John, did you have a chance to read those?
I have not had a chance to look them over.
Okay.
But if they look good to you, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the minutes as so written.
Seconded
by Chris. Okay. Perfect. Then those minutes are approved. So I guess first thing on the agenda, we'll talk about the dealer tour information. Are you going to talk about that, or Craig, or how you want to do that?
Well, I would just say we had the opportunity to have Alan and Larry and Cole with us. We went to several different locations, as we always do. And just for the record, our dealers were really thrilled to have that with us. They do that annually, and to have the outreach is really important. And so I don't know if they got a cheering squad, but they got one, because we appreciate what they do. So our membership was really appreciative. So for the record, we'll tell Alan, Larry, Cole, thank you.
Yeah, Alan Shinney from the division. I first and foremost, I thought it was what was most effective about the tour was the information sharing that went back between the industry and from the division, and the issues that are facing the whole automobile industry moving forward. There's no doubt that things have changed on us pretty quickly. It's how we're going to deal with it as a whole, instead of just certain facets of it, is how we'll be all successful. And that includes our part too. I think for sure, obviously I'll go over some more stuff here when it's our turn, but we have to have open communications to navigate through some of the challenges that are going to be in front of us. But it was a very good tour.
I agree. Kirk Schneider. I was able to go on several of the stops, and it was very effective and very important to have you guys with us, because I think it gives the dealers a lot of confidence in what you're doing and what you're doing out there to help, and talked a lot about titles and those things. And it's been a crazy few years, and your help has been invaluable. So thank you. Okay. Then let's move on to the tax commission reorganization.
You know, when I put this Alan Shinney for the division again and the tax commission, I was hoping to have a lot more information. Information is not following an expedited factor, but I'll do the best I can. So July 1st, which obviously isn't that far away now, Larry Ball is officially the new director of Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division. He will take it officially. Yeah, he will be the director as of July 1st. I will be moving into, they call me bad names, but a senior director position. And I will be taking over the tax fraud investigator section, MBD, and part of miscellaneous services, which does with the tow industry, and the DMV, all DMV issues that have to deal with dealerships. So it's going to be a monumental task. And with Wayne and Craig's group, I know that we can do it. We have a lot of good things to move forward on. Electronic titling across the whole industry is going to be monumental. It'll help us significantly with title fraud problems. And then just modernizing and saying, and I know I have an ex-DMV employee here, so I could cover her ears. This is Morgan Ludwig, by the way. She will be filling in for Maria while she's off on maternity leave. And Maria came to came to us from the DMV miscellaneous services. So we stole one of their star employees, which we never knew was going to help us with this reorganization. And trust me, we have two of them from that section that's going to be helping us significantly. I anticipate that there's going to be some struggles, and it's going to be about the modernization thing that we're talking about. The DMV's philosophy has been, we've always done it that way, we're not going to change. Well, that's not going to work anymore, because we are going to look at outside the box on all things, the secure paper issue that they are just, it's been a fight about, is going away. We can validate any document through NVIDIA's, through other databases instantly, that those old systems are designed for things that didn't exist 50 years ago. So I'm looking forward to the challenge, and we'll figure it out. I definitely guarantee we'll not be successful without the support from the used industry and the new industry, because there's lots of things that we're going to have to look at. Scott Smith is the executive director of the Tax Commission. He has been amazing and been innovative on a lot of these changes, and he wants to do things differently. He is getting beat up like to the pole from employees that do not want to change. So it is important that we know everything that we're up against and all the setbacks, otherwise we won't be able to fix it. So the egos cannot be into play, and they're not going to be on part of our management group here. We have to know what we're up against to fix it. And that's where I'm going to beg and plead with, I'm going to take the complaints from dealers, so it's not going to be a call center. And Larry will do the same thing. So we'll get good groundwork. And the good thing going forward is, we know the system. We know the system better than the DMV employees do. So I'm a working director. I have total access to the DMV database, and I have access to ours. Their directors do not have access to it. So I can do a transaction without authorization because I have access. That's going to change, and they're not going to like that. So we will be working to resolve the issue. So if there's an issue on the dealer side, I won't punt them to a call center. I will do it. I'll be working hugely with Wayne to fix these problems on the dealer side of it. And I'm going to definitely, as we move forward with electronic tiling, we'll be doing the same thing with new. We'll have to look at a lot of the scales they have on the 90% ratio on the direct platers. We're going to tackle that equation like immediately. That's going to be the first 60-day challenge. The setup costs for doing that, all things are on the table. I'm going to try to get those waived. Why should dealers pay for doing the state's job? To me, I don't understand that, and it's not going to. I know I'm going to, you're laughing, because it's going to not be easy. I guarantee you I will pull it off. I'm excited.
Make sure
about
we get that in the minutes.
Right? I know that. It's going to be in the minutes. And there were people invited today. They did not come. So yes, it's going to be a challenge, but we're pretty confident that we, with the support of the industry, we have to have it to move forward. So I'm excited about it. Morgan probably doesn't think that I know what I'm up in for, but I guarantee you, I think I do. So they might not know what they're in for, but they're going to learn really quick. Is that not true?
Yeah, I'm sure. I think I'd like to speak up from, you know, my side, as, you know, being in the recycling side, and this is a short time that we've been able to work with you guys, and the amount of help that's been to us as recyclers and being able to move this monster that we have, especially with, you know, the crime that we're having with catalytic converters, being able to move cars faster on our side. I mean, I can't even tell you, to us, it's like night and day difference. And so I'm really seeing the impact. My team is really seeing the impact. It's been, I mean, on our side. I'll just take my hat off to you guys. I appreciate everything you guys. Thank you very much.
And I think that's important. If you guys all remember, if you're in the board meeting where Chris talked about that, we made those changes based on his comments.
Yeah.
Because if I wouldn't have heard his side of the story, we would not have known. So we took over the dismantling permit process from the DMV, and we've generated probably close to 500 cases of violations that we found by us doing that. It helped them, and it helped clear a lot of the storage issues from tow yards and from their yards and to the crusher.
Well, I think, and back to what Alan's saying right now, I think where we've seen the uptick and all that is the current people that were able, they were selling us cars, and us being able to give you guys that information on the fly. You can see how many people are selling cars more than five and not being registered.
Exactly.
Right. And so I think that's really, it's, you know, listen, it slows down the short flow on our side, but what happens is that I think it puts more people on the radar of how they should be doing business. And that side of it, we can see the uptick starting to happen now. And so that's been huge on our point. It's huge. And so it's been great for my team to be able to have you know, contact with you guys. If we have an issue, they can call you and they know it's handled. So I appreciate you guys very much. Thank you.
So the manner review section, I will be over manner review. They just told me that last week. So that was definitely something I wasn't anticipating. That's a positive thing.
Yeah.
Because like when I first became the director in 2016, our staff would say, when they would get a new business, whether it was new or used, didn't matter, new business took 8 days to get licensed. I'm like, well, what are you doing 8 days? It just takes 8 days. I go, what are you doing 8 days? It took me 30 seconds to push that button. And they go, it takes 8 days. You don't know about this. You don't know about this. Okay, I did all that. It took me 30 seconds. Why? What takes you 8 days? They could never give me an explanation. Is that not true?
Absolutely.
We did away with that immediately. Well, they do a 30-day manual review on something that takes us 30 minutes. So the 30-day manual review is going to be looked at hugely. They have people over there doing other jobs that aren't supposedly focusing on the manual review. The 30-day manual review, which is putting used dealers in the failure to deliver title issue, is going to go away. So whatever staff we need to get to fix that issue is going to be resolved. That affects dismantling permits too. 100%. So it's a revolving door, and we found that out by what Chris brought forward to the board. So that's put us way ahead of this problem. So we're looking for those things, and with your help, we'll be able to fix it. If I don't get your help, I'm not going to be able to fix it, because the DMV employees aren't going to tell us because they don't want us to know. So we'll figure it out. So really, the next board meeting, I will be here at all the board meetings. I definitely, unless Larry throws me out, I'll still be here anyway, because I do his evaluations.
So
we'll be good. But I'm looking forward to it. You know, it'll be good. It'll be good for the industry.
We're looking forward to that too. It'll be great.
Mr. Chairman,
the timeline, but I guess you'll do it as expeditiously as you can.
Well, we're doing it right now, really. I've done some for Adam and Wayne right now. We do them every day. I did 5 today. So we're doing them right now. They just don't like it. Now they're not going to have a choice.
Okay.
Does somebody have a question on that?
Did you have a question, Glenn?
Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment. Just want to congratulate Director Shinney and soon to be Director Ball. And, you know, just also express my appreciation. You know, I've been in this industry for 24 years now as an owner, and to see people who actually care, that are willing to just get in there and do the work, is a rare thing in government. And I just want them to both know that we really appreciate them. And we look forward to working together, taking another step up the ladder and making change for the better. So thanks to both of you and congratulations.
Thank you.
Echo that. Congratulations, Larry. Good. Okay. Any improvements? Pending rule changes?
I can come that for you if you want.
Sure.
You want me to come there? Or yeah. Will this pick me up from there?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, perfect. Oh, yeah. It's like the one we can. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Wayne Jones from the Used Car Dealers Association. Adam is handing out 2 documents to you about a month or so ago, 5 weeks maybe. We had a joint meeting with the new car dealers, with the Used Car Dealers Associations. We had a meeting including Motor Vehicle Enforcement and their team, and then talked about the rule that we discussed, I think, at least twice in this advisory board meeting. There are 2 documents that you are being given right now. The first one that says draft on it is a piece that Jason Gardner from the Tax Commission put together so we have a basis to work from. I said, Jason, quit writing drafts. Let me have one that we can work with and make changes and go from there. So this is the last draft and the one we've been working from. You'll see that the lines are numbered on there, and I'll refer and reference the line numbers. And then the second page you have is a synopsis of some of the things that we talked about with the Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division and the new car dealers and the used car dealers in that combined meeting. So let me just mention a couple of things. Craig and I have talked extensively about this as well outside of that meeting. The first item on there has to do with vehicles in transit. If you look at line 25 through 27, that's new language that, and correct me if I'm not wrong, Craig, but that's language that the new car dealers Association came up with, working with some of the manufacturers to cover in-transit vehicles, correct?
More so, a little bit there, but more so with our own dealers as we travel.
So this has to do with in-transit of vehicles that have been ordered from the manufacturer but are not on the ground at the dealership. One of the things that we looked at from the used car side is, can we have this, how can a dealer who would purchase the used car, be it a new car dealer or a used car dealer, that they legally, if you will, own that vehicle, be able to put it on their website and offer it for sale? And so what we did is we came up with some language for that. If you look at that on page one at the top where it says vehicles in transit, just under there in the small print, it says for purposes of this section, a used motor vehicle which is in transit to the advertiser at the address given shall be considered in the possession of the advertiser. Remember when the language says advertiser, they're talking about the dealer, okay, person advertising that. If the advertiser has, and we put three qualifications in here, A, B, and C. A is a document showing proof of purchase. We talked about proof of ownership or something to do with ownership. That we felt like as the discussion went on, that that might include having to title vehicles. So we put a document showing proof of purchase and the date of the purchase to the advertiser from the seller. An example that would be dealer goes to Las Vegas Auto Auction. On the way home, they stop at a dealership in Mesquite or Las Vegas and they purchase a car. The guy gives them a wholesale purchase agreement or a bill of sale or whatever is the usual documentation for purchase of a vehicle at that time. B is a document from an auto auction. So if a dealer goes to an auto auction and purchases a car, he becomes the owner of that through showing proof of ownership, a proof of purchase with an auction receipt. All auctions will not release cars unless they have an auction slip. So that would be in an auction situation in a dealer wholesale auction or other auction environments. Then C is kind of more of a, what about the ones that we can't identify specifically, other related documents indicating the date of purchase. What we wanted to do is define this so that the dealer really has a legal interest or the vehicle belongs to them. We don't want dealers going to the auction, taking a picture of a pickup truck, getting the VIN number and putting it on their website because they don't legally own that. The part that I thought was most important here is the next two paragraphs, particularly the second one there, that talks about giving MVED the tools they need. Upon request of Motor Vehicle Enforcement Division investigator, advertiser shall produce all documents in his possession pertaining to an advertised motor vehicle indicating purchase or ownership of the advertised vehicle before being advertised. This is where it will be very specific to the dealer in the rule that they got to have some kind of documentation. They can't just say, yeah, I purchased it. They got to have some kind of documentation. If that's so, then there's an advertising violation for that. And you have the authority to issue those citations and the fines that go with that, that $250,000 and $5,000 penalties that are accompanying that. So we have specifically for a dealer to look at those types of things, see what works, and then an enforcement tool for motor vehicle enforcement. This would mean, let me give you an example of a couple of things. And a couple of those things are a lot of times with dealers' DMS systems. So a dealer purchases a car at the Vegas auto auction on Thursday. By Thursday afternoon or Friday, that vehicle is put in their inventory. That's going to go into their website. And that vehicle may not arrive at their dealership until maybe Friday or Saturday, but they are the legal owner of that vehicle. We don't see those types of things as being, and we got to remember what the subject here is, deceptive advertising. That vehicle is legally owned by that dealer and can show proof that he purchased that vehicle for that. Comments or questions?
Not from MVD.
No. Okay, perfect. So what we're going to do, and by the way, we're going to submit this to Tax Commission for them to put this. This is the language that we put together when we had our discussion with MVD and Craig Knight. I'm sure Jason Gardner will fix all the legalese that we do with this with the same intent. The one thing that I brought up that is not on your sheet has to do with consignment. And I don't know if we want to address this in the advertising piece of that. I know that a dealer who consigns, has a vehicle consigned to him, has to have a consignment agreement. And whether we should put in the advertising rule that you can't offer a vehicle that you have for consignment unless you have a consignment agreement. Any thoughts from enforcement side at all?
That's
about
basically
that?
Already in the rule.
Right? I mean, that's why it's good. I haven't had, this only came up this afternoon. I like 11 o'clock today. Okay, so I haven't had time to research. It seemed to me that consignment's already covered in there, but I wanted to be sure. So
that's in the statute.
Okay, so we don't need to worry about that in this piece? Okay, perfect. Less work to have to fix. The next one is on line 35 through 36. This has to do with advertising a price on a vehicle. Starting in line 35 and 36, if those are the last two lines of that draft, when the price or payment of motor vehicles quoted, the motor vehicle shall clearly identify as to your make and model and if newer used. Great, no problem. The problem we're having that I'm hearing out from the dealers a lot, and it's probably best illustrated by giving you an example. A dealer advertises a $25,000 pickup truck as $25,000. That's his advertised price. When the customer gets to the dealership, all of a sudden $1,000 or $1,200 has been added on for other ancillary things like undercoating, window tinting, window etching, all those add-on kind of things. What I tried to do here is delineate between those things that are already on the vehicle, because for us, and Craig and I talked about this morning, that it seems like it's very deceptive when you advertise the base price without including those things that are already on the vehicle that you can't do anything about. So this language, actually, what we're talking about here is adding on line 39, which is on page 2 of that draft, adding on line, because things that you have to include in the advertised price is freight or destination charges, dealer prep, and dealer handling. Those things are already in the advertising regs. We propose adding to that and undercoating or rust-proofing charges, window etching, window tint, alarm systems, or any non-optional item installed on the vehicle at the time of the advertising. So if that vehicle already has undercoating or rust-proofing, you got to put that in the advertised price, because it's not going to be optional. How do you buy that without? Okay. Questions about that or comments? Everybody good with that?
I think the only concern that MBD would have is it's still that way anyway, but now if a customer comes in and complains that I didn't want undercoating and they said I don't have that option, then we find out it was already done before, it's fraud.
Right.
It wouldn't be a rule violation. It could be a potential fraud case.
Could you prosecute them under one or the other, or is it if one take precedent over the other?
Well,
or is it
if how it's you crime, it's charge? Definitely a higher level than a violation.
Right.
In 210 or 41.3.210, it gives us the option to go either way. Okay. It just depends on the severity of it.
The reason I put that in there, and as our discussions went with our board and the meetings we've had, is that it seemed to me that it needs to be clear to the dealers that what they should and should not be doing when you put the price of the vehicle in there. To me, this clearly identifies that if it has those things and you can't make it optional, it needs to be included in the base price, because this seems like a really classic bait and switch type situation.
Colbert just brought up a really good point. I don't know how much undercoating costs, mm-hmm. but the severity of the crime would be based on the dollar amount.
Right.
So, I mean, that's changed. That's a game changer.
The question came up too, how is this going to be enforced? I can tell you right now, because we see a lot of it and it comes from our dealers, the dealers are going to be, because it's creating an unfair, unlevel playing field out there, the dealers are going to be the ones that are going to call you and say, hey, this is what, you know, this dealership is doing. They're advertising a base price and they're hammering people for freight, for undercoating, and for all these other things. And to me, that's really a deceptive act. Craig, you talked about this.
That's the trouble that we have, is that if somebody goes in there, it reflects poorly on all of us.
Right.
And they go, oh, well, it's this, no, it's that. That's just really very difficult. And it is what it is. And so
it is just deceptive. That's the bottom line.
But you're saying if we do this, it now becomes it's not a rule violation, it becomes a...
It could be fraud.
It really could be now anyway. If we just don't get complaints like that. They're hard to prove and they're hard to prosecute.
Mostly what we see now is on freight charges. You know, dealer advertise a price, then because it came from Florida, they'll stick a $500 add-on on that when they didn't advertise that in there. So,
yeah, if it's over $1,500, it's a third-degree felony.
Yeah, so
that's the limit.
Well, then there's the lower ones are misdemeanors, class A all the way down to fraction.
But between rule and prohibitive acts, which you referenced, you could do either, whatever you felt was appropriate, correct? Based on the amount and the severity and whatever. Yeah. So, okay. Other questions?
I was going to say, Kurt, what's your thoughts? You're hearing this kind of for the first time.
Well, I think it's, I think it's important that in the industry that we're as transparent as possible. And if you're going to charge for something, you should put that out. And if for some reason you can't sell the car because you've got $1,000 of whatever on it, and you think you're going to put that in the end, I don't think that's right. Obviously, don't put it on.
Yeah. But if it's on there and the customer doesn't have an option, it seems to me that it's
accepted. Yes, tell them. Alan Shinney for the division. We're all consumers in here. Myself, Larry Cole, buy motor vehicles. I went recently into a new dealer to purchase a little motorcycle for my wife and my daughter. MSRP on it was $2,250. When I asked how much it was out the door, it was $4,700. And then I started asking, well, how did you come to that figure? They told me, I go, I'm not buying it.
Were you wearing your pin?
No.
Okay. You're not wearing your sticker.
So you have the right to walk out of anything and say, I'm not going to buy that. It's the market adjustment thing right now that a lot of is very common. And I'm a free trade guy to the death. I mean, okay, don't buy it, but then don't complain about it too. And that's not how it works here. We get complaints for those type of things all the time. And I just think it's a business practice. Does the industry want repeat customers? They want people that can build their business, or do they want to take it at all costs and get you out the door? I can't answer that question outside of that happened to me.
Well, and beyond that, it affects it. Even when the bad guy does those things you were just referencing, it affects it.
And I'm not implying they're a bad guy. I just, they're not going to get my business that day.
Right. The next item, if there's no other questions, is on line 45. It has to do with what is not included on advertised price. And they struck out in this draft safety inspection. So your safety admission fees. We want to keep safety in there. So if safety comes back, that would be included. But also, I think it keeps safety on the minds of, you know, there's a lot of dealers who still safety inspect their vehicles, and some charge a fee for that, some don't. So we felt like that should remain in there, because we still have a safety inspection program in Utah, so it's not tied to registration. That's the only difference is before you couldn't get a registration without a certificate. Now, without a certificate, you can still get one even if you have a mandate.
But when the question be, is the state mandated fee if it's not required?
Right.
So, I mean, if you want to advertise, like dealers, in my opinion, should be saying we sell safe vehicles. That's the difference between buying it from KSL from a private person. I will guarantee you that you're buying a safe vehicle. So if that employs a safety inspection, so be it. But what are you going to do if they decide they don't want to pay for a safety inspection?
Right.
That's the question.
Well, and you're saying safety inspection has to be included in the advertising?
No, it's not. These are things that are not
included.
This would be like sales tax, age-based fees.
Oh,
safety inspection,
right. Yeah,
fees, emission testing. These are things that are not.
I mean, from my perspective, that's part of the repair of the vehicle.
Correct.
It's like an oil change.
Right.
We just pay whatever for the car, we recondition it.
Frankly, it's more of a housekeeping thing for me. Right. Why are we taking safety out? Let's keep it in, just for discussion. Okay, over on the page 2 on my outline, savings and discounts. This has to do with lines 56 through 64. This has to do with, this language was written like 50 years ago, or probably more, before I was even around.
One thing though, let me stop you. On the safety inspection thing, a lot of dealers have that built into their contracts in that section on the state mandated fee section. That's what I would be worried. Would you, Larry?
Yeah.
I would worry that that's almost the price of doing business argument now. I think that we were informed by the Highway Patrol that you could still charge for a safety inspection if you could really prove that you were doing it.
Yeah.
And not say that it's part of your 102-point inspection.
That's
that a lot
what we
of dealers
were told
do.
Too. We were told the same
thing. But you still would have that problem saying it's not required for registration. I don't want to pay for that.
Right.
I'm just letting you know that if it's added into your contracts pretext already, autofill, that may be a problem.
For me, this isn't a high priority item. It's more of keeping safety inspection in the discussion points and making sure we're covering that with the deal.
So if I could, Mike, just that prompts some thought process, critical form for the new car dealers. It just prompts that thought is that we want to be very careful with that everything is disclosed properly in those fees and so forth. we certainly don't want to get into trouble when it comes to application of that safety and nuance. We all know what we want to have in there, but from a legal perspective, is that the right thing to put in? That's, I think, the question that we're talking about.
Well, it's more important, do we need to take it out because it's already in there?
That's what I mean.
And do we need to keep it in or not? Is there a value in keeping it in versus taking it out? That's kind of the
You're saying, question. Take it out.
I'm not saying that. That's up to you guys. I just think if you go back to history on, if you issue a safety inspection versus issuing a temporary permit and there's a problem, then you could talk about an unwind or a violation. So anytime you charge for something and it's still, I don't think we took that out of the section. If it, let's say a lot of dealers do their own in-house safety inspection. If you do an in-house safety inspection and your staff really didn't do it, and they charge for it and they say, well, it's not required by law, there's a threshold there. There's no doubt there is. And I would advise, that's why all the dealers that took it to their someone else to do the safety inspection, the highway patrol, when they violated on the safety inspection, they took punishment, a punitive approach to the license safety inspection. When it goes back to the dealership, it's a violation and it could be all kinds of other issues. So I just would.
So that may be something we need to talk more with our boards about, whether we do or we don't, because for us, it's not a, you know, fall on the sword kind of thing. It's just discussion. Back to the savings and discount, moving on this on line 56. When this section was first passed, there was about the only way you could tell a value of a car was with a NADA or a Kelley book or some of the other dealer guidebooks, which typically wasn't available to the public. Now we have so many resources for that in today's age, it seems interesting that with all the wide variety of research we can do, customers are well informed, and should we eliminate the safe discount savings portion of that? In other words, I have a vehicle on, dealer has a vehicle on their website and they haven't sold it for a couple of weeks, so they discount it, put discount it this week or do a special on it or whatever. Talking to dealers, they say we see that all the time of people offering discounts or rebates or other things for that. Frankly, the rule says that you can't do that. You cannot offer a savings or discount on a used motor vehicle. I don't know of anybody who would, there's probably some out there. I think the general consensus is everybody has an opportunity to evaluate by year, make and model, condition, mileage. There's so many provisions. Look at all the services there are with Carfax, and you go down the list of what is there, 50 or maybe even more of places for the consumer to research a vehicle. We never had that before when this was written. So we talked and discussed that maybe this savings and discount section is obsolete, that maybe we just discontinue the savings and discount section.
This is the where you advertise was $10,000.
That was an example that is in the rule. Yeah.
Or another example, let's say that I have $3,500 and I put a slash and I put $30,000. It's the same thing.
Technically, that's showing a discount or a savings. Right. The other part of this that goes more global to this is virtually every other state in the Western United States, there's not a restriction for dealers to offer discounts on vehicles. By having that savings and discount restriction, does that put dealers at a disadvantage in the global market that we're in? And I know the governor's office comment was, we don't want to put our businesses at a disadvantage. We want to make sure it's an even playing field as much as we can. So I think there's something to be said about that too.
We would not contest any changes in that at all.
Eliminating savings and discounts.
What's the real world experience though? If you look at other states' advertisements, do they do it that way?
Oh yeah, all the states, they can do was now.
No, no, but do they?
Oh yeah.
You see dealers advertising that?
I've seen it, that's fine.
We even see it in Utah. There's a lot of dealers that offer discounts.
Do people even know that it's a prohibition? I mean, really?
Well, I have staff that go through that all the time, and trust me, they know. So we find them.
Have you had trouble with that? I mean, has it been?
It goes in cycles. We haven't for a long time because we've tried to use a three strikes you're out approach, where we will contact the dealer and say, this ad was found on this day. This is a violation. Will you please change it? And they do. They do every time. We have not
Sure.
We very rarely have had a dealer not change their ad. They'll say, we didn't know. Well, if you talk to Wayne and the people, the other people that do the training in the state, you should know because it's in the rules. So they're required to know.
They don't want to get signed.
Yeah. So that's not what our objective is. And a lot of it is depending on what level it is. Like, we've seen some pretty bad ones.
So is that?
When you're seeing like you're way over book, guess what? We see people right now that are way over book on the new site and they're getting away with it. We're finding them.
Well, there's a lot of vehicles that are overbooked. I mean, I'm not a dealer, but there's a lot of vehicles that are bought overbooked, just even on a wholesale basis. So the question, I think the question is how you disclose that to the customer. Is it deceptive to say Wayne Jones Auto Sales is offering a $300 discount on this vehicle for Memorial Day weekend sale?
20 years ago, it probably was. Now it's not.
That's what I'm saying. This seems to be outdated with the information that's available out there. To me, it's old.
Yes. So what was the purpose of this? Obviously, none of us were there 50 years ago, but in concept, what was this rule trying to solve? And that was, you know, deceptive. We all have a tough image, whether it's a new or used car store. And so how do we mitigate some of that unrealistic and some of it's realistic image?
Well, I think maybe, and I'm just saying this because I'm just thinking about timeline here, right? So we, you know, see how far, you know, we came with the internet now. When was this in place and how much was it all about, you know, print, right? And so, you know, we probably get to that stagnation time where a lot of the laws that we have, we're back in the point where today we have the internet that's so powerful, like what Wayne says, that it's really hard to beat it, right? Back in the day, you were dealing with print, right?
So you were lucky to have a native book price that you could get from a dealer.
Maybe it's the timing, you know, that's what I see.
I'm not saying one or the other. I'm just saying, are we helping or hurting the industry as a whole?
It's hurting the industry, in my opinion. I agree with everything Wayne said. I mean, it comes down to the, let's say Tear Apart has, and I'm not picking on Tear Apart, let's say Tear Apart's car, they want $3,000 for it. And three people come in, they get into a bidding war. What's the difference? There's no violation. You could sell it for whatever they want to pay. It's the same philosophy going the opposite direction. If you don't want to buy it, don't buy it.
I'll give you another example. In the rule later on, in about line 211 or something like that, it's at the very end of this document, is rebates. Isn't a rebate just a way to discount? Now, anybody can offer a rebate, new or used. The rule says if you're going to offer a rebate, you have to disclose who it's coming from. Is the rebate from General Motors or Chrysler? Or is the rebate from ABC Auto Sales? Because they can do their own rebates.
What's the difference? Which happens.
We talked about this in our education class. But they could do a, what we see is a rebate, like a Memorial Day weekend rebate of $300 or whatever. So really, that's just another way around this savings and discount issue.
You just have to buy the rule now. You have to say, let's say it's a recognition of service rebate.
Right.
You have to put that in the terms that all people may not qualify.
Correct.
That's in the rule now.
The only problem now is it says, was 10,000, now 14,000.
Yeah, now we're going the wrong direction.
That is true.
Paul, you want to tell us about your story?
And don't put MSRP on there. Your manufacturer will be happy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, moving on from that. So I think we're pretty clear on that. Lines 97 through 120, this is mostly a new car issue that it talks about demonstrators and executive cars and official cars. I guess the bottom line for me is, do we care what we call them? Basically, they are vehicles that have never been sold or leased to a member of the public. Can't we condense those lines 98 through 116? Can't we just consolidate those to say, if there are any of those three types of vehicles, those are vehicles, do a definition of what they are, get rid of all that language in there. They also, every one of them say kind of the same thing. So that's what we talked about doing. And they have a problem with consolidating that.
I don't know if there's much of those anyway.
Yeah. So basically what we do is consolidate that down in the rule to a simple definition of what that is, so it was clear there. Okay. Last one is on your draft is on line 117 through 120. This is what they kind of classified as commercial vehicles, meaning taxi cabs, law enforcement vehicles such as police cars, sheriff's cars, highway patrol cars. These are vehicles that were not currently branding. They don't have a title brand to them. The rule basically is saying that you can't just generically call them a brand. If you know they're a taxi, you have to sell it as a taxi. What about what we're doing today with a vehicle that's used for Uber or Lyft or leased vehicles that have a lease contract? Or, for example, one of the examples that was given to me is we see a lot of trucks coming off a corporate lease where these vehicles have been used out in the oil fields and they're just beat to living daylights. Those are worse than what a taxi cab or a police car would be. Even police cars are kind of different anyway. One of the comments was, there may be only 30,000 miles on the police car, but there's probably, you know, all these hours of idle time because I think they spend more time idling than they actually do driving down the road in many cases. So the question is it's not a title brand. How do we know their history? Does this create a liability issue for a dealer? So he has a vehicle that he purchased at auction. It's a vehicle that may be used for Uber or a commercial purpose, and the dealer doesn't know that. Does that create liability for the dealer when he doesn't know about those? Because we don't do any of that tracking at all.
I'd like to recognize Commissioner John Valentine. He just joined us.
How you doing?
Grateful to have him here.
Thank you. Yeah,
anyway, to answer your question, we do not brand for those things right now.
Exactly.
And it's not even on our radar, to be honest with his recommendation to make to the DMV. And I last time I checked on this, I admit it's been at least 5 years. There was only like 15 states that branded for those
things.
Yeah. I'm going to be speaking at the AMBA conference in 3 weeks. I can address that with the DMV committee because there's law enforcement committees and DMV committees, and I can ask them. And I can also refer you to AMBA's website for most of their best practices
yeah.
And see what they say. But I would say that you're just talking about a way to really devalue a vehicle that should be based on sight and you as a consumer taking it in and having it inspected to protect your investment more versus, because I mean, what if it's like our law enforcement cars that are turned into the state, their oil changes are meticulous, they're inspected, they're done this. That car, in all honesty, is sought after for a mystique thing of having a police car.
Most
so why would you want to make something that's going to bring it lower value? Plus on the Uber side, those vehicles are licensed, registered, insured by a private person, and they have to pay more money for insurance for there. So why would we want to even make a recommendation that would devalue them?
Right. Oh, and it's the unknown for the dealers too.
Oh, I got an answer to that. In Washington DC, that Uber driver, I thought I was in a NASA program.
You don't drive on I-15 very often because I'm there every day and I feel like that every day.
It's a week to get my head unspun. I mean, that guy's passing cops.
So anyway, the proposal in this was to do away with those as well.
I think that makes
sense. I mean, it's a common sense.
I mean, when we wrote this, they were all, every police car was a Galaxy 500. So.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
When you're Galaxy 500.
Our contract changes every year for what we can get. You can't even control it.
But if there's not a brand on it, I don't think we should differentiate.
Right? Well, it should be, yeah.
Okay, next item, and we're almost done, is on test. They call it, the attorney called it a test trial. The industry term is a test drive. I'm not sure why we need to call it a test trial or not. There's a couple things that we need to be on a test drive is that there was a piece in here. It's the right line here. It's on line 149. So it talked about a free driving trial or similar offer. The exact terms and conditions of the offer shall be set forth in writing. It's on line 151, and a copy given to the purchaser at the time of the sale. So the way this rule is written says, if I do a test drive or a driving trial, so it states here, I have to do a disclosure to the customer when I sell them the car. Of what my test drive, well, it seems to me that's kind of after the fact. That doesn't make sense to me to say, okay, now we got to give you a disclosure because you test drove the vehicle, but you're buying the vehicle, and that's why we have to do it, is at the time to say it.
Well, I think there's probably, I mean, the last couple of years, everything's changed, but
yeah,
you know, there were guys saying, hey, drive this car and bring it back in 7 days if you're not satisfied.
Right. So Volkswagen did that.
Yeah, yep. I'd call that a test
drive. Or a test drive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not too hung up on the vernacular necessary. It just seems like sometimes I think we need to stick to industry terms so the industry understands it, because that's what it's focused at. So I can have a discussion with Jason on that. The last item kind of applies to this as well. On line 155, it talks about deposits and down payments. And in here, the language talks about that a deposit or a down payment basically is always refundable. Department of Commerce has similar, in their Consumer Fair Practices Act has similar language. And in under consumer, it says that not in every condition is a down payment or a deposit refundable. For example, I'll use an example. Somebody wants to take a car for a week. I want to take an SUV that's 2 or 3 years old. I want to see if it'll pull my boat to Lake Powell. Well, if you're going to put $500 down, Mr. Customer, if you're not going to buy it, we would like to have at least part of that deposit go to compensation for having that out of our industry. We see that, you know, not often, but we see that. I think whatever language is here, we need to keep consistent with what commerce says and what we have in the advertising. And I think there should be an allowance for a situation if somebody does not want, if they want to have put a deposit and there's going to be part of that that's not going to be refundable, as long as it's disclosed before that happens, then it should be allowed to say, you know, part of your refund or part of your deposit is not refundable. Those are the discussions that have gone on.
Can you do that?
It's about if it's a contract signed. It's a purchase agreement. If it's signed and it's not part of the terms, it's debatable even of that, because it's subjective. My recommendation would always would be on something like that is, if that's part of it, towing your boat to Lake Powell, then why don't they do a test trial instead of signing the contract to make it binding?
I've had this discussion with Commerce on numerous occasions, because in my mind, there's a difference between a test drive or a deposit and a down payment. To me, a deposit is something that somebody gives a dealer a deposit on with intent to buy. A down payment to me is tied to a contract, a finance. I'm going to put X amount of dollars down based on a signed contract. But a deposit is, hey, I want to put a deposit on it to see if I want to buy it, and I want to see if it'll pull my boat.
You Commerce definitely could not use a dealer plate for that, though, for sure. Definitely could not use a dealer plate for that.
We won't get into that. But so Commerce is the same way, though. Commerce is saying, whatever the case is, as long as you disclose it, as long as you disclose to the customer whether it is or it is not refundable, is what their section of the code says. And all I'm saying here is we need consistency between that and this when they draft that language. Okay?
That's a good point.
Last item on here had to do with rebates, and we already talked about that. A rebate is really a way of offering a saving here at this town. What questions can I answer?
The one question that we NDD would have, Ms. Alan Shinnick from the division, is we did talk at our last board meeting about the 41.3210, and then it's listed in the 877 section about allowing any police officer to go in and pull records from a dealership. That's not being discussed, and it really should, because we're having a lot of issues with F&I issues now with the dealerships in their then redacted copies and not being protected under grandma being released to the public. We would think as an industry that would be our recommendation that be addressed, because the reason why the statute was drafted is we didn't have a motor vehicle enforcement investigator spread out throughout the state. MBD has been spreading. We have officers all over the, we're covered now, all the whole state. There'd be no reason for a San P County deputy to go into a dealership and pull a sales jacket when they have no knowledge of what to do with it.
Right.
And then the ramifications of them not redacting certain information could be a federal violation now too, from what you talked about on the door. So those are things that I think that as an industry we should deal with. We will help. We will help any agency with an investigation. We've been given instruction through the governor's office, through Commissioner Valentine, through Scott Smith, that we are a monumental agency that will assist in any motor vehicle related investigation. So that law is probably old and outdated, and for consumer protection, I think that it should be looked into.
Yeah, and that goes to the law side, because we talked about this at our joint meeting. It also had to do with confiscation of dealer plates. We limit that to a motor vehicle enforcement investigator. And I think that's going to have to be in legislation as opposed to rule. I mean, we can have Jason look at that, see if that's the case, if we need something in rule. But I think that's going to be more of a change in code than it will be in rule.
I think one thing we need to keep in mind.
So then December, is that would an officer, not one of us, goes in and gets paperwork, but that's what could be in jeopardy if they released him?
I think it could. I think it could without, I mean, we have to protect that information. So to give it to someone, you know, of course, it's not something they've taken into consideration in putting the rule in place. I mean, we would have to have some sort of an agreement, a protection agreement with you, that you're protecting that data according to what the rules are, wouldn't you think? I mean, you would be treated as a vendor, and somehow we have to know that you've got all the things in place that data is protected. So to just hand it to someone is a problem.
Even though it's, you guys got governmental immunity, we don't.
Well, what my recommendation would always be, why we've been working with legal teams on big dealerships, are they should be stamping it who they disclose it to. We do. When we release something, we disclose it, disclosed and put who it's done for that very reason, because
they cannot disclose.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And I would recommend the same thing. That would help. I'm not an attorney, but that would help. In my opinion, that would be a big difference between you'd have a grammar violation versus you don't, because the statute clearly says you give the information to a police officer, you give the police information, because technically you could be shut down for that if you don't.
Well, right. And obviously law enforcement has a different standard, but that's probably a good idea.
I would stamp it every time.
Alan, I think we could probably do some clarifications in the code, and that's going to be beyond Craig and my, at least I can speak for myself, that's well beyond my scope of knowledge. So if we could have an assistance from the tax commission about what they would like to have in there that would work for your enforcement side to do that, we're happy to.
I would recommend that you draft something up. That way I can go to my bosses and say, this is what's being proposed and what's our position on this.
Okay.
I would keep one thing in mind, and I'm glad Commissioner Valentine's here, because he will give you clarification on this. My last instruction was that the governor's office right now is pro-business and doesn't like rules that regulate and hamper business. So in my opinion, if we're messing with a lot of rules, we better be asking, why are we doing this? Is there really a clear path to what we're trying to accomplish? Because we're not going to be able to do this every year. Otherwise, we could jeopardize the whole rule section. Is that the way you understood it?
That's actually a good summary. One of the problems we have is that we've actually submitted some rules to the Administrative Rules Agency for publication and had them rejected without even having the public comment period being started. They're being rejected because there appear to be restrictions on business that were unreasonable restrictions on business. And so we're being sensitive to that. So we've been instructed at VED of the same kinds of problems we're having, trying to get those rules through. So it's going to be interesting to see if that continues, but that's the present landscape.
So I think these proposed rules we just went through is a good indication of that, of this is old stuff we need to move on with. You know, we're not impeding business. I think it fits into a lot of stuff we talked about and what Commissioner Valentine just said.
But to ask this, Commissioner, you a question. So back up here, we're really sensitive, and you know what Alan's talked about, we've talked about it for months about the FTC and disclosure and safeguards and all that information. I mean, it's big time penalties, it's big time work, etc. So to us, what Alan is suggesting, that not just any law enforcement officer can come in and take stuff. We don't like that. So would that be something that, now, this would be a statute change, certainly.
It would be a statute change. Right now, for the tax commission, which includes MBED, we have 659.1, 403, and 403.1, both of which impose significant penalties on anybody who discloses from our side. So that would be a redisclosure from something that they got from you. Those penalties are felonies, misdemeanors, and a five-year height is that you can't be employed by the state for anything. Oh, those penalties are real and they're heavy sanctions. So that redisclosure is what I'd be more concerned about. When you have a lawful request from a police agency, you got to honor it. Okay? And you're kind of finished at that point. But the policy consideration of the police redisclosing it, that's probably something worth looking at.
So in that same context, then, you have that, but what other police agencies around have it? Do you have any idea?
That's one area that I don't know the answer to. That's why I said that's something worth looking into. I don't know the answer.
And maybe we can create some consistency in the draft of legislation.
You probably could. I do know that there's post sanctions for redisclosure, so an officer can lose their post certification. But I don't know if that's statutorily based or if that is something just within the post world. Maybe Alan could tell you about that. I don't know the answer to that.
But would it make sense that because motor vehicle enforcement is over our industry, that they ought to really be the gatekeeper because they know our industry the best for another law enforcement agency to come and say, we want this, this, and this. The courtesy would be to come here first before, or is that looking at that?
That's a policy call on the part of the legislature, okay? Because they're going to have to then be responsive to the public safety community and try to balance out those policy decisions between the legitimate needs that the police have an investigation versus something that may not be legitimate or that may be a redisclosure of something that they've received. So you've got to be careful as you walk through that, knowing that you've got a whole other world of public safety world out there that we have our hands in because we're public safety officers. But that is something that a policymaker, the legislature, is going to have to make.
Yeah. Thank you.
I knew when I come down here, I couldn't just sit quietly.
That's because you think so much.
I think the main reason why this has merited so much discussion is the federal ramifications from their new project they're working on with disclosure violations. And I will tell you this, the tax commission takes disclosure very seriously, and we have disclosure training all the time, and we go over all these issues. We do everything we've told you. Where we've had issues on our side is we've got requests from other law enforcement agencies. We give them the stamped copy, and we've had disclosure violations on their side that could affect the industry.
So, Craig, one piece, just an FYI, is their Senator Cullimore had a bill last year that passed. Yeah. The implementation date isn't until December of 23, so we're a year and a half away. There's obviously going to be more changes to that coming this session. Maybe we can look at implementing or putting something that might tie into that because it's the same privacy issue subject. But maybe we could put something in that draft of that. Just, yep, got it.
Yeah. This is very broad, and they take it from Virginia.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Mr. Vice Chair, just the other thing, last thing I was going to mention on rules is during the last couple months, two, three months, we've worked on the doc fee sign with the commission. That went to final hearing and is open to the final comments, which end on June 15th. So there'll be a new doc fee sign required. In all dealerships. I have seen probably six different versions out there. Most of them are incorrect. So we need to make sure that the dealers are getting the right information. There was even an education class that still had the and profit in there saying you need to sign, and the new sign showed that you still keep and profit in there, which is incorrect. So we need to make sure that the dealers are getting the right information on the new that right now it's in the final 30-day hearing process, and I correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner,
like by
June 15th, we'll end that. So, yeah.
So when does it go?
Well, what happens is that's when the final comment period will be over, then I'm going to come back to the commission for final public comment period if anybody has something they're going to say in the public hearing, and then we'll adopt it in the public meeting.
So has there been any comments to this point, or are those
even that I'm aware of on that one?
Either.
Good thing.
So we think that new final language, there was just a tweak by Commissioner Gregan, responsible wording on the very next part. It's going to be different.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't get on Zoom call. I'm sorry, guys.
Thank you for joining us.
Nice to see you.
Thanks for coming.
So anyway, that's the last piece I had to do.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Renewals?
Maria?
No.
Let me do it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Last year was a record year. We're 1.5% above last year. So the used car dealers are the lowest. But.
Yeah, but there's a lot more of us.
And they're actually lower than last year.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, so new cars running a little bit above. Our salespeople are actually 2% above what we were last year, so it's going good. The portal problem. What problem was that fixed? What's going on that you guys have a problem?
Yeah, I think it was just maybe the date or.
Till the date.
Or our gal didn't put it in the.
Okay.
The system.
So it got worked out already. They got like.
There was, the portal was upgrading last Friday, so there was some problems last Friday is what I was told.
Yeah.
Maybe that's.
That's probably what it was.
There's only been a handful.
We're telling everybody that we do classes for, get it in now. Don't wait till the last week of the month. Just get it in now. Do it electronic.
Yeah, I mean, electronically.
We do that at the beginning of the class and the end of the class.
And what I said, we're above, so that's good. That's a good thing, but we're all being above.
We're looking at some changes with renewals for next year. The licenses won't be coming out on secure paper anymore. You can print them from your own printer. Our guys can, I mean, you would not believe how much that paper costs us. It would have happened this year, except for I have like some just Hitler youth people that just won't let things happen. So anyway, it's going to happen. She knows I'm not talking about her. So anyway, next year, our goal is we want to have salesman's license. They will not have to, some dealers renew their salespeople, some do not. So we're going to do an app that they can do it just like you do your concealed weapons permit. You log on, take your picture with your smartphone, submit the document, you make arrangements to pay the fee, and the license will be, you can generate it on your a PDF. So that's going to happen. We're going to do that. So that's going to be a good thing. That'll help a ton. What else were we going to do with that? Is that the only thing?
Yeah, that's the only thing. We're just going to do everything. I'm trying to do
everything. Yeah, we're not going to mail out things. We're going to really tackle our mailing budget. When I first took over, our mailing budget was 25,000. Now it's below 10. It's going to get lower. It's not necessary. We did run into an issue where Cole actually delivered some temporary permits to hand deliver to a big dealer. They did not like that. I don't understand why they didn't like it. When I called their general manager today, he says they will talk to them. We had an issue with FedEx where some things got lost or we were doing some tracking. So I pulled the whole batch and had them delivered just to say, is there anything we can do for you? And this particular finance person did not like that.
Was it the gun or was it?
No.
I had nothing showing at all. I had this showing and that was it.
So you delivered your permits?
Yeah. And I got a butt chewing.
Really?
What was their problem?
Or did they say? They wanted mailed and they didn't want anybody having access to them and only one person can open them. And
probably FedEx will just drop them on the front porch and not worry about it. That's what happened.
They mail it, it could end up in St. Louis. We order plates all the time over. We order 50 boxes of plates, so one of them will always end up in the Midwest.
That was what the issue was. So it was no bad thing. It was like they weren't there to get questioned or nothing. It was just to drop off permits. So, but I did call.
They might have just had a bad day and took it out on me. I was the lucky one, but.
And we want to look at getting rid of that with temporary permits totally. We want to go through a different program where a decal would be met and you could do it on your own through the portal yourself. And we'll use track it through the sequence number. And then you can print it. A lot of the dealers on the tour complain that they're running out, having options, not being able to buy those printers that we need to generate those. We would have gone a different route, but COVID messed everything up. When does our new contract end?
In like a year, I think.
I think it's longer than that.
Is it?
Yeah, so it was.
We just barely signed it, I think. So I think.
No.
We had 4 years left.
I don't think it's that long.
Your temporary permit printing?
Yeah, well, we put with the batches that we use. We're definitely going to be looking at the whole, doing it a different way. We whether it'd be easier for, we'll have to still to take into account that we have some used dealers in rural Utah that don't have computers, and we will take care of them. We'll figure something out. We'll figure whatever we got to do to look at that, but we're looking at some modernizing some things that just make a lot of sense.
For example, in a dealership now, we have to post everyone's sales license, all that. Is that, I mean, it's not a problem, but is it something that will continue, or, I mean, if you're going to?
Is it still necessary, I think is your question.
Yeah, I mean, is there a way to have it electronically? I mean, I'm not really, I don't know what the purpose of it is, other than to know that everyone's licensed, and it reminds us, you know, maybe we have.
That could be addressed. I mean, we're not going to oppose that. I mean, you can get your driver's license on your smartphone now.
Right.
Put it on a TV monitor. Well, if somebody requests, I think it's maybe easier just to say you have it available upon request.
I agree. I don't think we.
Well, if you have a question whether somebody's licensed or not, and you did it on your phone, like your registration on your car, now you're going to know if the dealer's in violation, right?
Totally.
Could be some.
Yeah, that's something we look at.
Some of the other, some of the other professions that we deal with also have gone that direction where they're not required to have them on the walls anymore. They just have them available. So it's not something that's new. A lot of the other.
I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever looked at it.
Yeah, I don't know how that you've got encompassed that, but generally you're required to have your business license or your MBD license, and then your, is it your insurance?
Mm-hmm.
And doc fee. We don't care about the sales approval thing. They just, that, we inherited that. I didn't do it.
It was from before where some dealers were not licensing their salesmen, and so when the investigator went in, if you weren't on the wall, you'd get started. That's kind of what. That's why they wanted them there, so they could actually see.
I can't even do that with my department now because I have turnover so much right now. So it's like, maybe that.
Electronic would be the way to go for that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
All righty. Future legislative discussion?
It's coming. We don't necessarily know what it is yet.
Less is better.
I agree totally.
Okay. Nothing more on that. Stolen vehicles.
I hope everyone understands, and maybe you guys could both do it through bulletins and just common knowledge that if a vehicle gets stolen from a dealership, more than likely it's not going to be in their name. We need to help get the title in their name. We'll waive the fee because we'll have a police report. It's $6. We'll waive it. They need to have that title in their name because we're having a ton of cars get stolen, recovered. They sit in impound forever, and the cost gets huge. And it's definitely more on the used side. It's going to affect used car dealers because the Morgan did impound sales. The cost can get like astronomical. We want to do everything we can to prevent that. There's been a lot of requests more on the used car side than the new car side that we as MBD be an agency where they list stolen cars, because a lot of the law enforcement agency will not list them on NCIC as stolen. We're looking into that. It's a lot of it comes down to dispatching questions that we may be able to overcome. And we do have an attorney coming on board. That will probably be one of our first items of business. If the industry doesn't want it to us to do it, then we'll back off. But most of the requests have come. Have you ever had a car stolen from you?
I have. Not for a while.
Was it a bad experience or a good experience, or how did it turn out?
That was crazy.
Sign up.
I'm talking about recovery.
Well, we recovered them. It's a good question. It wasn't fast, but we did get them back, you know, fairly timely matter. One we prefer not to get back. I mean, it was destroyed, but they did recover.
One of the problems out there, though, is if a dealer has a car stolen, let's say they steal at your place and it ends up in impound yard in Ogden, you never get notification because you have a title in your office or an MSO or something.
Right.
Else.
That I never, but, so the title's in your name.
Yeah, you bought it at the auction, so, it's my name on.
Yeah, I'm never going to get notified.
Well, here's
and that's piece, I didn't.
Never here's the piece of the puzzle that we gave to the dealers in our education class. There's under UDOT, their services they offer is where you can go on there just like an impound yard can, open to the public, open to dealers. You can go onto the site, you can type in the VIN number, and that will tell you if it's in an impound yard somewhere in Utah. So I was told the dealers will put in an education class. You have a car stolen, you get on that website and find out. I had that exact, before that law passed this year, I heard some things with that. I had a dealer up in Ogden who had a car stolen a year and a half ago.
was ended up sold, but he come to find, he didn't know where it was, how to track it. It ended up being found in a impound yard in West Valley City and had already been sold. So he was out $31,000. We didn't know that there was this resource even available to dealers to track those things. So now that is, and the gal there, if impound yards are not treating dealers the way they're supposed to and charging for things they shouldn't, they will go to battle for you. And they're really good about getting it.
So. Many years ago, I did have a car stolen and it sat in this impound yard until the final day. And then they said, this car is going to be sold. And that's when they notified us on the impound. The storage fees were more than the car was worth. That was a long time ago.
That was the problem.
A couple thousand bucks.
But the sooner that the vehicle gets titled, because a lot of dealers will have the customer's name, or they get the title, they're not in the dealership's name, or we would have to take into account the flooring companies, like Cole just reminded me. We can put like it in the dealer's name and a flooring company's name, but we don't want those cars just out in the limbo, because they will get recovered eventually, and then that'll help prevent, because as soon as it goes through an impound, then the owners are notified, right, through the impound notice? They're notified. If they're not in their name, they're going to notify the previous owners. They get it in the mail. They're like, I don't know this car. I traded it in. I don't care. They throw it away.
But on stolen cars or stolen license plates, and if the tow yards only enter the license plate, stolen cars never going to be discovered until the impound sale. Right. So.
The impound yard is also supposed to notify a dealer. If the dealer put a temporary permit on there, they're supposed to notify the dealer.
But remember, most of the time they take those temporary permits out because they're using them on other cars.
Sure.
So that's really not going to, whatever we can do to help, I just don't want, we get a lot of calls on this. And it seems like it goes, we're in that season right now. They're going to start happening.
So if you title it in my name, I get a car stolen today, you title it
immediately
tomorrow or whatever. Then when it gets impounded, they're going to see that.
And then you'll be notified.
How long does that take to process?
But that may not necessarily happen.
Supposed to do it immediately, right? Once it hits their yard.
That isn't going to happen, I don't think, if you have the title and somebody else, you title it after the impound happens.
Correct. But if I title it and it's already an impound, then it may, they're not going to keep checking.
Correct.
Yeah. But what you're, I've never heard of what you were talking about, where we could go and see what cars are impound.
Yeah, it's the impound vehicles.
But if it's impound on a state tax and it's not in your name, they're not going to release it to you.
It's under UDOT is where it's at. And I didn't know it until I was working with some towers on that towing bill last year where that was paid.
We will do that. We would come give you guys a presentation as well to your dealers. But everyone should know that if they get their car stolen, they call their local agency, call us, and we'll get it.
We always tell them to report both ways.
And maybe eventually they just don't call them, they call us. But I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Any other business? Well, we sure appreciate you guys. We appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this board. I think it's important, and we're able to discuss issues and make changes that are good for our industry. So thank you all very much for all you do. Thank you for everything. And we will, I don't know if we have a meeting scheduled next time, or we'll just send out a notice.
August.
I think it's in August.
The 13th of August. August 15th.
Okay. 2:00. Perfect.
Thank you, John and Clint.
Thanks. Thanks, guys, for calling in. Hope you feel better, Clint.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, keep resting up. I'll be good as new by next time.
All right. Be careful.
Thank you.
See
everyone.
All right. I guess we're done. Oh, you need a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
I think motion to adjourn the meeting, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay. Second. I'll second it. I'm here.
Yeah.
All right. We are adjourned.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. See you guys.